Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled The Monk Who Questioned Chenrezig by Lama Tom Broadwater. This is the chapter title from Ringu Tolku's book, Confusion Arising from Wisdom, a commentary on Gampopa's heart advice. Presented in story form, this chapter provides some pithy clarifications for various difficult points that may have us puzzled. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning. My name is Tom Broadwater. I'm with the Columbus KTC. I'm Associate Lama there. You have tuned in to the 11:30 Dharma Talk, so I'm really happy you're here. So what I'm going to do today is basically a book review. A couple of weeks back, I was talking to my friend Kevin. We meet about once a month and do Dharma stuff, talk together about Dharma. And he had this book called Confusion Arises as Wisdom. And he really liked the book. And so we started chatting about that book. And he particularly liked the second chapter, which is about a novice monk who questioned Chenrezig. So we're going to take that chapter. And as a matter of self-disclosure, I have to tell you that probably 75 to 80% of what I say today will actually be from that chapter. I make no, I am a plagiarist, and I'm very honest about that in my plagiarism. But I figure that someone like Ringu Tolku, when he speaks, even through a translator, his words are going to be better than mine. So I'll have some commentary, but basically it's going to be Ringu Tolku's words. And the book is basically a summary of Gampopa's heart advice on the path of Mahamudra. A really good book, and I certainly recommend it. But again, I tell you that I'm a plagiarist, and I take much of my talk from his thoughts and to a large extent from his words. So let's get with it. So it's the second chapter of that book, and it's called The Monk Who Questioned Chenrezig. In that chapter, Gampopa tells a story about a novice monk who goes to a great Mahasiddha by the name of Dambipa. And he wants some instructions. And Dambipa has a really strange response. He says, I'm not going to give you any instructions. I want you to go to my student, Atisha, because you have a karmic connection with him. And what he says to you will have much more meaning than even I as a modest Mahasiddha might have. So being obedient, the monk goes to Atisha and says, would you give me some instructions? And so Atisha gave him some instructions, and they were about Chenrezig. And he gave him a liturgical practice related to Chenrezig. And the monk was very diligent. He practiced every day this practice. And he became so good at it that he actually experienced seeing and talking to Chenrezig. So he goes back to Atisha and he says, Atisha, I can actually talk to Chenrezig. So give me some questions to ask him. And so Atisha did exactly that. And so this whole talk is going to be about those six questions that Atisha gave to this novice monk to ask Chinrezig. And those very same questions are questions we could ask ourselves. In fact, I invite you to ask these questions to yourselves as we go along. So the first question was, what is the essence of Dharma practice? Good question, isn't it? What is the essence of your practice? Can you answer that question? What is the essence of your practice? The second question that was given to the novice monk to ask Chinrezig was, what are the obstacles to your practice? Excellent question for us. The third question was, what should we emphasize when we're actually practicing? What is it that you emphasize when you're practicing? Good question. Then there's sort of an outlier. How many consciences are there? And I'll explain why that's sort of an outlier, but an important question nonetheless. The fifth question he was to ask Chinrezig, and we can ask ourselves, is, among all the views, which view is most important? And finally, the question to ask Chinrezig was, what causes the perfection of all the accumulations? In other words, what causes Buddhahood? So the student took those questions, went back and meditated on Chinrezig, and asked these questions to him. And Chinrezig answered them one by one. So the first question was, what is the essence of practice? And Chinrezig answered, the essence of all Dharma practice is bodhicitta. The great teacher Paltrow Rinpoche said basically the same thing. He said he had read many great sutras and tantras as well as commentaries, and he'd received many pith instructions and teachings and practices. But in all of these, he found nothing but the teachings on bodhicitta, from beginning to end, from the noble truths to the great teachings on Mahamudra. Everything is included in bodhicitta. Some teachings lead to that understanding. Some teach how to increase it. And some talk about the results of bodhicitta. But there's nothing besides bodhicitta in the entire of Buddhist teachings. So what is bodhicitta? Well, it's enlightened or awakened mind. Bodhi means awakened. Citta means mind. So it's an awakened mind. We can define bodhicitta as having two aspects. Many of you already know this. And those two aspects are wisdom and compassion. And these correspond to the two main types of bodhicitta, relative and absolute. Relative bodhicitta is the compassion aspect, which focuses on benefiting others. And the absolute bodhicitta is the wisdom aspect, which focuses on perfect awakening, perfect enlightenment. So relative bodhicitta, now we're going back again, there's ultimate and relative. Now we're taking relative bodhicitta, and we're saying there's two aspects to that. there's the aspiring bodhicitta and the engaged bodhicitta. In a way, these two reflect the aspects of compassion and wisdom. With aspiring bodhicitta, we have thoughts like, I want to become enlightened in order to help all beings, help them to find lasting peace and happiness. So compassion is a driving force of aspiring bodhicitta. So just like you don't want to suffer yourself, you don't want others to suffer. And so you generate this bodhicitta by thinking, I want to free beings. I want to free myself, and I want to free other beings from suffering and pain. Engaged bodhicitta goes a little bit further. It says, since I want all beings to be free and I want to be free, I'm going to work on it. I'm going to be engaged in that process of being awake and helping others. It's sometimes pretty frustrating trying to be helpful to other beings. We all know that. We see pain and suffering in others, but we really don't know how to help them. And so this is where the wisdom aspects come in, even here. Unless we can sense the possibility of being completely free from suffering, we would never say, I will make this happen. It wouldn't happen. So we have to have some sense of that. And that's where the wisdom aspects comes in. With wisdom, we understand why we can be free from suffering and why lasting happiness and peace are possible. These are all possible. So bodhicitta must have both compassion and wisdom. With compassion, wisdom has a goal. And with wisdom, there is at least some understanding of what that goal is and why we might be able to reach it. So we can say, even in relative bodhicitta, there are both aspects of compassion and wisdom. Bodhicitta brings wisdom and compassion together. One way this happens is that our compassion grows. And when that happens, our self-centeredness decreases. With less self-absorption, our attachment and our aversion decrease. And with this less attachment and aversion, the more wisdom we have, that grows. So in this way, compassion leads to wisdom, but the reverse is also true. It can go the other way. Wisdom leads to compassion. Now, what is wisdom? Wisdom, according to Rengu Tuku, is the direct experience, of the true nature of our mind and the world. As our understanding grows stronger, we become more fearless. As we become more fearless, we become less self-centered. And this leads to less aversion and attachment, and this makes compassion possible. Bodhicitta is an awakened heart. It's the heart of the Buddha. The Buddhas are simply beings who have developed their wisdom and compassion to the fullest. And so, with highly developed wisdom and compassion, you have true peace of mind and true fearlessness. And you are genuinely accomplish the well-being of beings. So this is why bodhicitta is the essence of Dharma practice. It is the essence of your practice. It's the essence of my practice. Now, the second question is, what causes obstacles to our practice? Probably you already know. But Chin Rezig answers it. Obstacles are caused by the ripening of karmic effects. We'll explain that in a minute. And then Chin Rezig goes on to say, even the tiniest ordinary action can become a hindrance when it ripens. Obstacles are sort of interesting. One important thing about obstacles is they aren't permanent. When we're enduring them, we often think, oh, this will never end. It's insurmountable. There's nothing I can do about it. And of course, that's never the case. We just have that thought. Everything occurs as it does because of causes and conditions coming together. What we call karma is simply the fact that actions have consequences. Generally speaking, negative actions have negative consequences and positive have positive consequences. A person's karma is the cause and conditions that form your personal life. There is a saying in Tibet that if you want to know about your past lives, look at who you are now. And if you want to know what your future is going to be like, look at your actions now. You don't have to be a fortune teller to know what your past has been. And actually, you don't need a fortune teller to understand what your future life might be like if you look at your present actions. You are now the result of past actions. And your future will be the result of the actions you are performing right now. If you are doing things that are negative and becoming accustomed to it, then you don't have a very bright future. If, on the other hand, you're doing skillful and positive actions, your future will be much better. Bottom line, we need to be careful about what we are doing with our body, speech, and mind. Sort of an aside here, sometimes people get really upset when they see other people doing negative stuff. But we don't have to be concerned about that. That's really not our concern. How other people act. The place for your attention, the place for my attention, is on how I'm acting. If you behave well, if I behave well, most of the problems solved. The important thing to really keep in mind is that we can never control other people. We may be able to influence them if they permit us, but we can never control them. The only person we can control is ourselves. What other people are doing or not doing is really nothing of our concern. No one has appointed us to make judgments or assessments of other people's actions. And when we get caught up in thinking about what other people are doing or not doing, we lose our stability. I have a friend that I talk to once a week, and we talk about Dharma stuff. And he gave me He gave me a picture of what happened to him in the past week. There was just one episode after another of people causing him unhappiness, he said. For example, two elderly women parked on his property were eating lunch and discarding their wrappers and bottles and stuff onto his property. So he goes up and he said he had a good attitude about it. He went up and he said, I'm picking up these this garbage here, but I wish you wouldn't do that. Well, the women became very incensed, really angry, drove off, but not before raising their hands and, let us say, an obscene gesture. Well, this disturbed my friend a great deal for a long period of time. It was disturbing to him because he felt violated. He felt hurt. And we talked about it for a length of time. And I think by the time our conversation was over, I think he wasn't so upset. I think it's like this. If we're clear about our own intention not to cause harm, and we're doing the best in that situation, then to a large extent, our problems with others are over. We can be clear, as he was, and he can be confident, and we can be positive. Then if something unkind happens to us, what matters? What does it matter? You don't need to get upset. If someone is unkind, that's just, you know, that's the way it is. If they're nice to us, that's great too. But if that doesn't happen, if they cause us problems, it's important for us to remain stable. When our intention is never to harm, then normally, in most cases, people will treat you in the same way. And when that doesn't happen, no big deal. It's important to be stable and clear. People will play games. Let them play the games. It's okay. You and I know we're not going to play the games ourselves. We don't have to. So returning to the main point, which is about karma, Gampopa is saying that even the tiniest actions can ripen into big obstacles. And so if we don't want to have these obstacles in our path, then we need to make sure we are performing skillful actions. And the strange thing, or not so strange thing, I guess, the thing that can happen is even a small action that seems rather harmless, but sometimes they can ripen into something very negative. And the opposite is also true. So the tiniest action can have major consequences. Our former president, President Bush, described what he experienced on 9/11, which was not everybody doing heroic things. Some were. But what he also noticed was many people doing little acts of kindness. And that had a major effect on people's memories of that day. So when we're talking about the ripening of karma and it causing an obstacle, we're also talking about positive actions. Yes. Say, for example, I'm meditating and I'm really growing in my meditation. One of the side, shall we say, experiences of meditation when we are doing it well is we become very sensitive to other people. We start noticing how they feel, how they think. We almost may think we're clairvoyant, and people may think of us as being clairvoyant. And then we start thinking, well, gee, I'm almost close to Buddhahood. Gee, I'm clairvoyant. So this positive action that I perform can actually be an obstacle. Big point here, major point is we have to be careful about our body, our speech, and our mind. What's going on there? So the next question that Atisha gave the monk who asked Chenrezig, the next question was, what should I emphasize in all my practice? And Chenrezig answers, the emphasis in practice should be on cause and result. What's he mean by that? Well, it actually follows from the last bit that we talked about. Gampopa is saying that we need to be cautious about our karmic effects. Exactly what are we doing right now with our body, our speech, and our mind? Is it we're doing something positive? Then we should rejoice. Is it that we're doing something negative? Then we should look at its harmfulness and drop it. This point was frequently emphasized by Kempo Karkyu Rinpoche. One time he was quoting, I think, Guru Rinpoche, but I'm not sure, when he said, your view should descend from the vastness of the sky, but your action should ascend like a ladder from the ground. So what's he saying there? At every moment, whatever we do affects ourselves and others. Whatever we say affects ourselves and others. Whatever we think affects ourselves and others. If we ignore this, then the high view that we might have results in our being stranded in the air. Another way to look at this is what Padmasambhava expressed by saying this: don't be overly influenced by the view. What he meant is that according to the view of emptiness or the teachings of Mahamudra, ultimately there is no karma. There's no good, there's no bad, and there's no personal self. And although on the ultimate level, there is no results to achieve, we need to be clear that on the relative level, the level we're working on right now, everything is happening. And even the tiniest actions have consequences. And when we ignore that, when we just have this high view but ignore our conduct, what we say in terms of a high view is hollow words. And if we try to maintain a high view without regard to our conduct, we're liable to at some point or another wind up being very jaded in our Dharma practice. So we need to be careful. We need to be very careful about cause and result. And this is the point that Gampopo is making. No matter the spiritual practice we are doing, we need to be careful about our actions. So it's wonderful to have a high view, and we'll talk about that in a moment, and see things with equanimity. But that does not negate the ground we are walking on. We need to be aware of how our actions affect our lives and the lives of those around us. And so that's why Gampopa says the emphasis in practice should be on karmic cause and effect. Now going on to the fourth question. Among all the views, which view is most important? And Chenrezig responds, among all the views, the most important view is the right view. Now, I'm sure you're like me in saying, well, what is the right view? What does Chenrezig mean by the right view? Well, I think he means that we have to look for that view, that right view, and come up with it. We have to look. And we have to look for ourselves. We can't simply take the views of others and simply say, well, I agree. It's much more than that. It's much more than that. We have to consider the matter open. In Buddhism, the view could be a philosophy, sort of a simple abstract collection of propositions. But it's more than that. It's much more than that. It's the way we see things, the way we understand reality, and that interpretation of reality profoundly affects our thoughts, what we think, what we feel, and how we act. So view is very important. And the way we come to that view is we find the right view by seeing things directly and as fully as possible. The right view is broad-mindedness, it's openness, it's a complete view that is not one-sided, nor is it dogmatic, nor small, nor narrow-minded. It's tolerance. It's being able to look at things directly and genuinely and without preconceived notions, without being controlled by old assumptions. Sometimes you'll hear people say, my tradition, my teacher explains the view perfectly. So it must be the right view. Other views must be wrong. According to Rinko Tuku, this is a profound misunderstanding. The right view is very open, and it's never restricted. This point was emphasized by the teaching of the Buddha when he said, when he talked about the errors, the two errors. He called them holding the two as best. And in this case, the first would be to hold that my conduct, my character is the best way to act. And the second is to think that my view is the best. The Buddha said that these are serious mistakes Because when you think your ethics and your view is best, your mind closes. Closes without hearing all the alternatives. So the Buddha's warning us about a wrong view. When we have the right view, we don't hold on to anything. You're open and you accept things as they come. This is similar to what Nagarjuna once said. He said, he was a great debater, and being able to understand the subtleties of Dharma. He said, I make no assertions. I only ask questions. If other people's views crumble in the face of my questions, I can't help that. He wasn't trying to harm other people. He was simply trying to approach the truth. Having the right view means making a genuine personal search for what's true. Buddhism emphasizes debate because we got to know the truth for ourselves. And actually, we can debate anything. All of Buddha's teachings are open to question. But questioning, and while they're valuable, and debates valuable, they can never find the whole truth. The whole truth is not bound by concepts or intellect. The real truth comes through experience. Having the right view is a process of gradually seeing ourselves and others and all things just as they are. I say this is a gradual process. It's not something we gain overnight. The point is that our seeing comes from within and comes from introspection, analysis, personal experience, and meditation. This happens slowly and stage by stage. As we continue to study and practice, our understanding gets clearer and clearer. The view is open. It's limitless. There's a saying in Tibetan that if there's grasping, there's no view. When you have the right view, you are free of fixation. The right view is total openness. On to the fifth question. Fifth question was, how many consciousnesses are there? In Tibetan philosophy, we will find people, scholars saying, there's one, there's six, there's eight. So forth. Depends upon the school of philosophy you happen to adhere to. And you know what Chenrezig says? He said, you can consider there being one, you can consider there being six, you can consider there being eight. But, and this is a little shocking, he says, it doesn't matter very much which way you classify consciousness. He says it doesn't matter a lot. So he's not saying that it doesn't, that debates are not, that they're important. Yeah, they're important. And they can be interesting. But for me, more often than not, they're confusing. Usually when people debate, they play with words and twist the meaning a little bit, you know, so that their opponents end up saying something they didn't intend. This is a part of the debate. There's another old saying in Tibet that if two scholars agree, one is not a scholar. If two saints disagree, one's not a saint. What are they saying there? Well, they're saying that, in other words, true realization is the same for all. If two saints do not have a similar experience, then one of them is not a saint. But philosophers are quite different. If two philosophers agree, then one is not a philosopher. It's important to remember this when you study the teachings. When two great scholars debate, they tend to assume that one of them is right and the other is wrong. Likewise, why would they, I mean, otherwise, why would they debate? There would be no reason to debate. They would both think they're right. And neither was wrong. But they have this idea, I'm right and you're wrong, so let's debate. There are stories about scholars and philosophers debating for years at a time. In fact, there was one famous debate that went on for 7 years, and it was about what are the best words to use when explaining the Dharma. And so that little debate took 7 years. The point here is, I think, not so much about consciousnesses and those sorts of things, but recognizing that when we are reading Buddhist scriptures, when we're reading about these debates, when we're trying to learn about some of these exalted concepts, difficult concepts, subtle concepts, when we're reading about these, scholars and philosophers are trying to explain things that are difficult to describe in words. That's why the debate goes on, and that's why we must meditate. Because, as we said earlier, the truth is not found in simple words, but in our experience. And it is through our meditative experience we get to truth. The last question that Chenrezig answered was, what is the cause of Buddhahood? Or what is, how do we, he put it another way, it was, how are the accumulations perfected? From one perspective, Dharma practice revolves around two accumulations, the accumulation of merit and the accumulation of wisdom. Merit's a really tricky concept. I remember one of the first questions I ever asked Kempo Kacha Rinpoche in one of the 10-day teachings. It was my first 10-day teaching. I went, I asked a question towards the end of his talk. And he, I think maybe because he knew I was brand new or just out of compassion, he spent a great deal of time explaining to me what merit is. We tend, as Westerners, we tend to see merit as sort of like a badge. I was a Cub Scout many, many years ago. And every time we achieved something, we got a little merit badge. And that's how we tend to see merit in Buddhism. But it's not like that. It's not a thing. It's not a prize. It's not a medal. And it's not something awarded to us. Kimpo Kutsu Rinpoche explained it very simply as this: the accumulation of merit means doing positive things and developing positive habits, so that our negative tendencies are reduced. When we accumulate merit, we become so accustomed to acting and reacting in positive ways that our negative emotions barely occur. So it's not so much a thing. Merit is more of an action. And so once these negative emotions subside, we no longer perform negative actions with our body, our speech, and our mind. Now, to switch to the accumulation of wisdom, the same thing, same idea also applies. Wisdom does not mean the accumulation of information and knowledge. It means understanding and realizing the way things truly are. That's wisdom. It's learning to be completely natural. It's learning to be completely who we really are. The accumulation of wisdom means that our wisdom has become so strong that we see everything fully and completely. And someone who has developed their merit and wisdom to the fullest is a Buddha. Basically, the question posed to Chen Ruizhi, what is the best way to become enlightened? What is necessary to perfect merit and wisdom? And Chen Ruizhi's response is the paramita of wisdom. That will make the two accumulations complete. The general way we accumulate merit is by doing fewer and fewer negative actions and more positive ones. In the Mahayana, this is equivalent to the five paramitas: generosity, discipline, patience, diligence, and meditation. Reinforcing positive actions definitely helps, but it does not cut the root of our negativity. Without wisdom, the good deeds of body, speech, and mind, they have a positive effect, there's no doubt about that, but they cannot liberate us from our suffering, from samsara. All they do is contribute to having a better samsaric life. They can't bring us to enlightenment. It's the sixth paramita, the paramita of wisdom. It's the only thing that can liberate us. Seeing deeply who you are, the nature of your mind, frees you from grasping and aversion. It is through seeing what is true that will cut the root of samsara. If you can completely see yourself the way you really are, then you can be free. If you can completely relax, you can be free. If you can let go of your insecurities, if you can transcend your traumas, you can be free. knowing things directly and completely and being able to relax within that knowing, that's the key to perfecting merit and wisdom. So let's review. What is the essence of our practice? Bodhicitta. What causes us obstacles? Our karma. What should we emphasize in practice? Cause and effect. What is the most important view to have? One of openness, unprejudice, complete openness. Of the different views on consciousness, which is the most accurate, it doesn't matter. Because all of our talk only helps us approach ultimate truth. It's like the finger pointing to the moon. So in one respect, it doesn't matter how many consciousnesses there are. And finally, what will result in our becoming Buddhas? Our perfection of wisdom, our being able to see fully and completely who we are, and what is reality, what is true. That will free us and we'll become Buddhas. Well, thank you very much for your attention. I'm finishing up a little early, and so if there's any questions, I think I'm able to see them on my screen. I may not, we'll see. If you have questions, you're more than welcome to raise them. And if not, we'll end up a little early. So again, I want to thank you all. I don't see any questions coming up, and that's fine. No problem. So I will end here now. I ask you to consider Columbus KTC is in the final stages of developing their building. And if you would like to donate, you can go on their site and do that. They're very close to finishing, I might say. It's a beautiful building, and it's going to be even more beautiful when we can inhabit it. And that may be a few months, who knows. I wish you all, there is one question. The question was, maybe you've answered this question, but how do you accumulate wisdom? An excellent question. We begin by observing our conduct and trying to create more positive behavior than negative. That's essential. Conduct is essential. And going beyond that, we work on our meditation. And at some point or another, we will need a spiritual friend to help us in our meditation, especially as it reaches the higher levels of meditation. But for right now, you and I, it's most important that we pay attention to our behavior, our conduct. And then slowly, slowly over time, through meditation, we will start being able to see the true nature of ourselves and the true nature of reality. Again, that most often requires a spiritual friend who has some experience in that area. So I hope that that helps you answer the question, how do you accumulate wisdom? Again, thank you very much for being here. There's nothing more precious in Buddhist thinking than your own time. So allowing me to take some of your time, I understand the preciousness of that, and I thank you for that. So I ask you all to continue to practice. May you have a good week, and come on back next Sunday at 11:30 for another Dharma talk. So, thank you. Let's dedicate the merit of this talk for the enlightenment of all beings and for the overcoming of wrongdoing, which is our enemy. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from this ocean of suffering we call samsara, may we free all beings. May you and I together free all beings. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.